Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we're continuing our week-long series on California's water crisis. Yesterday, we talked about the severity of the drought. You can find that show at yourcallradio.org. And today, we are talking about our complex water infrastructure. It's an extensive and intricate system of levees, aqueducts, and pipes, which supply water to 25 million Californians and 3 million acres of farmland. So how does the state's water delivery system actually work? Two-thirds of California's water comes from the snowpack north of Sacramento. Two-thirds of the demand for that water occurs south of Sacramento. So how is it delivered? In some cases, water travels over 440 miles. How efficient is this system, and what needs to change? With longer dry seasons and dry conditions in 98% of the state, how should investment decisions be made? California's growing population is expected to reach 48 million by 2030. So what changes and investments need to be made to meet that demand, and is that possible? Today, we're joined by David Sedlak, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the UC Berkeley. He's co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and deputy director of the National Science Foundation's Engineering Research Center on Reinventing the Nation's Urban Water Infrastructure. David is author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. And he joins us from UC Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good morning, and thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Adam Scow, California Director at Food and Water Watch, an organization that works to ensure that the food and water we consume is safe, accessible, and sustainable. Adam serves on the planning committee for the annual California Water Policy Conference, sponsored by Public Officials for Water and Environment Reform. And Adam joins me in studio. Hi, Adam. Welcome back to the show.
Hello. Good to be back.
Great to have you. So, David, I was just watching this really interesting video in which someone from the Department of Water Resources is interviewed about how water is developed. And he said that it would take hours, maybe even days, to describe this system, which I thought is very true. But something he mentioned in there I think is so interesting, and that is two-thirds of California's water comes from the snowpack north of Sacramento. Two-thirds of the demand for that water occurs south of Sacramento. And he says over a 100-year period, the state has developed one of the most complex infrastructure systems in the world to figure out how to deliver the water. So how
it sure has, yeah.
Yeah, how would you describe it? You wrote a whole book on this.
Well, I wrote a book about things broader than just California's water delivery system, but it is truly an engineering marvel, and a lot of thought and development went into it. It really began when the people arrived in California, and in the first half of the 20th century, that was the main focus, getting the water to the people. So we built systems to import that water to Southern California from the Eastern Sierras, or the Hetch Hetchy system, which brings drinking water into San Francisco, and the McCollumy system that brings water to Oakland and the East Bay. And so that was really where we were until the post-war period. And then after the post-war period, we got serious about flood control, hydroelectric power production, and supplying water for those people that are in the southern part of the state, and growing food. And so we made major investments in this intricate plumbing system that now takes care of our agriculture and drinking water needs today.
We move water over 440 miles through a canal system. We lift water over 2,000 feet over the Tehachapi Mountains, the highest lift of anywhere in the world. What else would you add to that? What might listeners not know about the water delivery system in the state? David?
Well, we also generate a great deal of power as that water comes down from the mountains. We also try to manage the way that the water is delivered so it doesn't interfere with the aquatic ecosystem and protects salmon and other important species. And a lot of the water that we supply for our cities actually comes from within the cities. So while it's true that most of the water that comes into Southern California is coming from the Colorado River and the Sierra Nevada Mountains, a surprisingly large amount of that water is actually coming from the mountains that surround Los Angeles and San Diego. And that water is captured in the mountains in reservoirs and slowly released to the city and used to recharge the local water supply. And that situation is true also here in the Bay Area with the Santa Clara Valley Water District, which actually delivers groundwater to its customers and tries to use a lot of the local rainfall to provide a drinking water supply that's not as susceptible to interruptions from earthquakes and also problems with the snowpack in the Sierra.
And Adam, I know that efficiency is something that you're really passionate about, but before we talk about that, what else would you add just about this intricate and complicated water system?
Sure. Well, big picture, it's important to remember California's water, about 80% of it is used by agriculture. That is by far the biggest water user in the state. We have a huge agricultural economy empire, you could say, in the Central Valley in particular, and in the Salinas Valley. Urban use has been going, has been holding steady and in some cases going down. Californians are becoming more efficient themselves. Oftentimes it's voluntary, and that's a very good sign. There's a lot of room for improvement despite growing population. So you look at Los Angeles, they use less water today than they did 30 years ago, despite population growth of over a million people. So it's a good sign, but there's a lot of room for improvement as well.
And we're going to talk about this in the show. The LA Times had a great story in California. Water use is all over the map, looking at consumption. Just quickly, San Diego County, for example, 584 gallons a day, and then Shasta, 365. We'll talk about that, and I'm glad you brought up agriculture. This came up a lot in yesterday's show. So when you look at this intricate and complicated system in California, how efficient is it?
Well, it depends on who you ask, depends on who's benefiting from the water delivery,
right?
And who's paying for it. We taxpayers, California taxpayers and federal taxpayers, both subsidize water delivery, the water infrastructure, and the energy used to move water from north to south, in particular to irrigate the Central Valley. We have massive water exports away from the San Francisco Bay Delta. Two-thirds of that water to three-quarters of that water exported south is going to the Central Valley. Less than a third is going to Southern California. There is a growing almond and pistachio empire on the west side of the valley in a very hot and dry climate. It's questionable whether that empire is in the public interest, as most of those crops are being exported overseas, which amounts to a virtual water export of California's water via those crops, which are very lucrative and making lots of money in overseas markets. So who benefits and whether it's in the public interest is really depending on who you ask. It's our opinion that some of these practices are becoming abusive of California's water, particularly when we're in a severe drought and we really don't have the water on the books, or nature can't deliver to support such a large agricultural empire in the desert. The Central Valley will always be a productive agricultural region, but we really need to think hard about whether it makes sense for certain places to be irrigated.
David, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, while I agree that there's room for improvement in the efficiency of agricultural water use, this is a political issue that Californians have been fighting about for over four decades now. And I think it's important to realize that most of the economic activity in the state happens in the cities, and when cities face shortfalls in their water supply and uncertainties about the ability to develop or to deliver water to people, it really creates a big problem. And I think we're going to see more focus on the question of how cities are going to provide themselves with water without being tied to these massive imported water systems. And so we're seeing a lot more energy being put into developing local sources for the state cities.
David Sedlak is professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Berkeley and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Adam Scow is California director at Food and Water Watch, an organization that works to ensure that the food and water we consume is safe, accessible, and sustainable. And today we are continuing our week-long series on California's water crisis. We're talking about our complex water infrastructure. What do you want to know about this extensive and intricate system of levees, aqueducts, and pipes that supply water to 25 million of us and 3 million acres of farmland? Do you know where your water comes from? What do you think needs to change? How do you think it could be more efficient? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 855. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. David, what would you add to that? What would you say is most efficient about the water system?
Well, the efficiency of our water system is the fact that we use gravity to deliver water to many places in the state. So notwithstanding Southern California, where we pump water up and over a mountain range, here in the Bay Area, for example, a lot of our water comes to us and generates electricity on the way. So, for example, those buses in San Francisco that run on electric power, that's electricity generated by the Hetch Hetchy Water Project. And so there are some very efficient aspects of our water system and some very inefficient aspects of our water system. And that's why a lot of the opportunities for developing local water supplies happen within the Los Angeles Basin, where anything we can do to avoid pumping water over a mountain range can really enhance the efficiency in terms of energy use and cost.
And Adam, what would you say is most efficient?
Well, it's a good point about developing local and regional water, because pumping water south is about 20%. Well, let me correct that. We use about 20% of our state's energy in moving water in California. It's very intensive. So the more we can do to localize and regionalize our water systems, the better. And Los Angeles has taken a good look at that, and many other cities as well, not just because it's better environmentally, but it's also better economically.
And what does it take to do that? Can you give us a specific example?
It takes hard choices about investment of ratepayer and taxpayer dollars. Right now, we have a huge shortfall in the amount of money we need to be investing in fixing our city's water systems, our sewer systems, and building stormwater systems so we better capture and use rainwater for everyday water use, and so it doesn't run off polluted into our bays and oceans, as continues to happen here in San Francisco Bay and in Los Angeles. That's going to require enormous investment. 30, 40, 50 years ago, we had a bigger partnership with the federal government in financing these major investments, not only because they're expensive and cities needed help, but because it was in the national public interest to have a clean water system as the foundation for the American economy. We're also going to need Washington to take a hard look about its own priorities and see what commitment really needs to be made in terms of fixing our water infrastructure. We fall short $22 billion
wow.
a year in this country. California EPA estimates we need to spend $80 billion on fixing all of our sewer and water systems in this state. So we have some big financial choices ahead of us. But in our mind, there's really no choice to be made. We cannot have California as we know it without a functioning water and sewer system.
Well, and so at this point, according to reports, the federal government is setting aside about $50 million with an M in federal funds for western states suffering from the drought. $29 million will go for a water reclamation project in California's Central Valley. What is that exactly?
Don't know the specifics of that project, but generally it's about harvesting and better using groundwater, which is a bit ironic given the rate of overpumping of groundwater in the Central Valley, where land sinks 20, 30 feet because of some of the agricultural practices there.
And we're going to talk about groundwater on tomorrow's show. David, since Adam brought up the federal government, what role do you think the federal government should play here?
Well, Rose, I don't hold out a lot of hope that the federal government's going to ride to our rescue, but I do see a lot of good signs that the taxpayers of California are interested in a secure water system. So Proposition 1, which passed last year, set aside hundreds of millions of dollars in water infrastructure spending, and the cities of California are also starting to invest in projects like the stormwater harvesting projects that Adam mentioned, as well as water recycling plants, that is to take municipal wastewater effluent and treat it to a level where it can be reintroduced to the water supply, and also conservation projects to further improve upon the progress we've been making on reducing urban water demand. And so these, to me, are a lot more likely to help us make our water system more secure and resilient than waiting for the federal government to allocate money to California.
David Sedlak is professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Berkeley and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Adam Scow is California director at Food and Water Watch, an organization that works to ensure that the food and water we consume is safe and sustainable. Today, we are talking about our complex water infrastructure. Two-thirds of California's water comes from the snowpack north of Sacramento. Two-thirds of the demand for that water comes from south of Sacramento. In some cases, water travels over 440 miles. So what questions do you have about the delivery system? Do you know how your water is delivered? And what changes do you think we need to see, not only to the infrastructure system, but also talking about investment in the system itself, because right now, and we'll talk about this also throughout the show, the pipes dating back to the 19th century occasionally burst. There's a lot of questions about how healthy this system is also. And we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's go to Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for this program. My questions, I guess I have two-part question. One is about the amount of water that actually is lost in transit from the Sierras to Southern California, that 440-mile trip through the desert, where these are open canals, and evaporation seems to be something that we should be thinking about. The other one is reservoirs which are 50, 60, 70 years old, sometimes older than that. How much of the capacity for water storage has been lost due to siltation? And I guess that's my basic question.
Thank you, Raul. David or Adam?
Yeah,
David.
So with respect to evaporation as the water is transported from north to south, that is one way in which water is lost, and there are parts of these canals where water also leaks through the bottom where they're unlined. And then when the water goes into the pipe distribution network, those pipes that we don't invest enough money in maintaining often lose anywhere from 5 to 25% of the water that we put into them. So there are a lot of opportunities for reducing water losses along the way. And there are people thinking about these problems. Unfortunately, they're tough problems. So in the 1960s, people suggested that you could put a thin layer of oil on top of the water as it went into the aqueduct to reduce evaporation. And there are even groups today experimenting with adding drops of food-grade oil to the surfaces of reservoirs to reduce evaporation. But that hasn't been widely adopted or embraced by the public. With respect to reservoirs, our reservoirs in California are not undergoing siltation to the extent that some of the reservoirs in other parts of the country have. But over time, they also need investments in maintenance. And the idea of expanding reservoirs, that is, making the walls of the reservoir taller to hold more water, proved to be very expensive. So in some ways, we're stuck with the reservoirs that we have. And their ability to store water isn't necessarily changing that much, but the idea of expanding them is not an easy solution.
I agree with that, and it's also why so many water advocates and experts agree that we really need to be the best way to store our water, especially in dry periods, is by recharging our underground aquifers. And so many places right now, we're overpumping them, especially as there's less snowpack, less rainfall, and there's becoming a growing dependence upon the groundwater, and highlighting some of the questionable agricultural practices that are drawing down some of these aquifers. We saw in Jay's op-ed in the LA Times that about we've lost 8 million acre feet of water approximately from groundwater in the Central Valley, and it takes a very, very long time to replenish that. So the state needs to step up its game in terms of managing groundwater as a public trust resource so we can actually have recharge. We can store water through droughts. Currently, groundwater is pretty much private property in California, and we're wasting it and we're losing it at very alarming rates.
Were you talking about Jay Famiglietti with NASA?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he wrote this piece in the LA Times that's getting a lot of attention. And again, we're going to talk about groundwater on tomorrow's show. This new legislation was just signed. It's historic legislation, and we'll talk about what's in that bill and the major players at the table, because everything's still being hashed out right now. So thanks again for calling in, Raul. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I wanted to ask about the delivery of water and billing through municipal water companies versus private companies. The analogy being that I thought that municipal delivery systems were more public as opposed to, say, private companies like PG&E that provide gas and electricity, but that's totally a private company. And I wanted to know the guests' thoughts about the delivery and billing and everything else through municipal systems versus private.
Okay, thank you. Adam?
Sure. Well, in general, private systems are more expensive. It's natural. They need to make a profit. We've done some surveys and studies that show private companies are 20 to 25% more expensive. The customers pay higher rates. And sometimes they get worse service along the way. They're cutting corners to maximize profits for their shareholders. PG&E is a good analogy. It's quite similar operation. And the regulation tends to favor the companies at the expense of the customers. But about 80% of California's water systems are public, municipally owned. Some of them overall do a very good job at delivering us water on a reliable and daily basis at affordable rates. However, we think they could be doing a lot better in terms of promoting conservation, efficiency, and being more resilient and responsive to customer demands, particularly in a drought. And I'll give one example. Over the last 3-4 years, as Californians were using less and less water voluntarily, it meant less money for some of these water agencies, and consequently they raised the rates to make up the lost revenue. So there was an effective penalty to customers who are using less water. There's also a concern that these public water agencies are annually raising their budgets, putting more pressure to increase revenues while we're in the middle of a drought. And we think that's an irresponsible approach, particularly when we have a lot less water in these last 3 years. Government agencies across the board, when times are tough, sometimes have to make cutbacks, but these water agencies are very reluctant to do so. So we want to see our public water agencies more respectful and resilient in droughts.
What about the oversight board? Have they been keeping an eye on this, and are they doing anything about it?
Well, public water agencies at the local level here in San Francisco, it's really a public utilities commission under appointment by the mayor. In the East Bay Municipal Utility District, you have an elected board of directors, so you have more democracy. You have 7 districts there, each accountable to their ratepayers. That's similar with the Santa Clara Valley Water District. So people don't know about these agencies or know very little about these agencies, but we need a lot more public involvement to ensure that these types of reforms, efficiencies are being prioritized.
Well, and now that this is getting so much more attention, and the Sacramento Bee has a piece out about California, actually today this is happening, California is going to consider a statewide mandate on landscape irrigation. They have not done this even during the drought of 1977. They're going to order every urban water agency in California to limit outdoor watering to specific days of the week. In many cases, this could mean 2 days a week. So this is getting a lot more attention. People are paying so much, people are paying attention to this. How could people raise their voices on that particular issue?
Residential water use, the big user, the big water, you could say, waster is lawns. Keeping lawns green, especially in a hot, dry climate, takes a lot of water. And these lawns are often not native to California climates. We estimate 40-50% of residential water uses for lawns, and oftentimes people are overwatering their lawns. So we support approaches to mandate better water use there. So that's a long overdue needed reform. And in some cases, people should consider planning things that are more appropriate for the California landscape.
And we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are talking about California's intricate and complex water system. We'll be back after this.
Listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-7262. Talk, 866-798-8255. You can also write, drop us an email if you prefer. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC. And at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor and Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about the new groundwater laws. These laws were implemented last year. It's the first ever rules for pumping groundwater. Nearly 40% of California's water comes from underground sources. But areas are being pumped faster than they're being replenished. So how is groundwater managed now? Who has a seat at the table? And what changes should we expect? That's tomorrow. On Thursday, we will talk about food choices. I know so many of you had questions about that yesterday, so I hope you can tune in tomorrow. How what we eat affects water. And then Friday, we're going to talk about media coverage of some of these issues. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about our complex and intricate water system. And I just wanted to give you more information on what I just mentioned. So the State Water Resources Control Board is going to vote on an unprecedented proposal today. And it would be illegal for many Californians to water their yard more than 2 days a week. Again, they're voting on this today, the State Water Resources Control Board. According to the Sacramento Bee, this didn't even happen during the drought of 1977. So if this is implemented, you might have 2 days a week to water your lawn. And I'm sure there's going to be other things in that. Today, we're joined by Adam Scow, California Director at Food and Water Watch, and David Sedlak, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Berkeley and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Do you know how the water system works? Do you know how your water is delivered? What are your thoughts on its efficiency? What changes would you like to see? And let's go to our next caller, Katie F. in Oakland. Hi, Katie F. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I agree with the gentleman who said that watering lawns is a waste, so I'd like to propose that we eliminate all golf courses except one per county. I think that would help. And also, I think it would be great if a startup figured out a way to cheaply adjust everybody's home plumbing so that we could have a divergent source, recycled or non-potable water, to flush our toilets. Using drinking water to flush our toilets is nutty.
All right. Thank you for that one. David, do you want to take that?
Well, using drinking water to flush our toilets sounds nutty, but then when you look at the complications associated with an alternative approach, it seems a little less crazy. So, you know, if you're going to try to deliver this second type of water, this non-potable water, through a centralized pipe network, you have to build a new kind of treatment plant and you have to dig up all the streets in the city and put in these new pipes. Mm-hmm. And when people started doing this in the 1990s in the San Jose area, they quickly realized that it was a lot more expensive than just delivering more drinking water to people's homes. So then the next thing that you think of is, well, couldn't we find a way to recycle water within our homes and use that saved water to flush our toilets? And that seems like a good idea, but then you realize that it's probably even better to just go for more and more efficient toilets. So when you have a toilet that only uses 1.6 gallons per flush, it's probably better, if you're going to recycle that water, to use that water for the landscaping around your house or other purposes. And so when you only have 1.6 or 1.2 gallons per flush, probably building a whole second set of plumbing in your house is no longer worth all the effort.
We have another home question from Amy, who says the burden of conservation should not be placed on homeowners. How much would it cost for the state to pay for all homes to be retrofitted with on-demand water heaters, low-flow showers, toilet sinks, and gray water systems? David?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what it would cost, but our utilities are trying to give us incentives for doing this. And this is where it comes back to the comment that Adam made before, where people complain about how rates increase during a drought period. And that really reflects a lack of understanding of what it takes to run an urban water system. So water is not like gasoline. We don't. The cost of delivering water doesn't scale by the gallon. It scales more or less by the customer. So in a time of drought, when people conserve water, it more or less costs the same for the utility to deliver that water. And so when their revenues go down, they have to let people go and decrease their investments in this decaying system just at the time when they need to redouble their conservation efforts and their investments in developing new sources. And so we have to be really kind of careful about how quickly we initiate indoor water conservation. And in fact, many people find that we're reaching a point where we've gotten as far as we should go with respect to indoor water conservation. So in parts of Western Europe and other parts of the United States, we're seeing that we've gotten so good at conserving water that our sewer systems no longer flow like they were designed to flow. Hmm. And when the sewers don't flow like they're supposed to flow, you get increased levels of corrosion. And the way in which the sewer department responds to that is they start running drinking water through the sewers to move the solids out so they don't cause the pipes to corrode. And so while it's attractive to think that retrofitting all of our homes with low-flow fixtures and all kinds of other wonderful water-conserving gadgets will be the answer, we're probably reaching that point with our own plumbing codes and our own continuing improvements in indoor plumbing. The real forefront for conservation is outdoor water use, and whether it's restricting watering to a few days a week or discouraging the use of lawns, or if you prefer to keep a lawn, putting moisture sensors and precision agriculture tools to work to run a lawn with 30 or 40% less water use. All of those things are really the cutting edge of reducing water demand within cities.
Adam?
I think this is some good points. I think California could still do a lot better in terms of its efficiency and conservation. We're not as close as some places in Western Europe or Australia have gotten, especially when we're in the midst of a drought. When you're in the drought, you have to manage, you have to be resilient, and you have to adjust. And so far, our California water agencies aren't really doing that in a very serious way. Much of the conservation and efficiency efforts are more about advertisements on buses and trains, do your part, California. But there's not a real serious partnership with homeowners and customers in a really methodical way about reducing water use. And I think it's in large part due to the revenue addiction. Mm. I think it would be more responsible for water agencies recognizing the drought we're in to need to cut back a little bit and understand that it's important to partner with customers to really reduce water use and have goals for doing that. We don't really see that happening right now. And there'll be, in California, we have dry years, we have wet years. There should be some elasticity in how these agencies manage it. Now that we're in a hotter planet, we're seeing the climate changing, we could see longer spells of drier periods. So water agencies are going to have to change. But they're not going to change on their own because it's a good idea. Customers, Californians, need to go make these demands of their local water officials.
So we talked about this yesterday, just what we could face. And it's interesting you point this out because I've seen a couple ads in BART take shorter showers. I've seen this in restaurants. Do you really need another glass of water? What would you like water agencies to do when you say they need to team up with customers? What changes do you want to see?
Well, at the local level, at the urban level, I agree with David. Really, it's much of the savings are going to be in the outdoor irrigation. This is more in places where there's lawns. Here in San Francisco, we're pretty low. We're one of the lowest places in the state in terms of urban water use. So that type of incentivization, replacing grass, in some cases getting rid of the front lawn. If somebody really wants to have a backyard, do they need 2 yards? What kind of incentives, goals, and partnership can we really run these programs in a way to deliver specific results and not just make it an ad campaign? So that's at the local level. When I see those ads, I'm also thinking about the statewide level because I work on these issues on a statewide level, and I think about the massive waste in agriculture and certain practices. And I think, well, certainly Californians are going to need to do their part. But let's remember that 80% of the water use in California is still going to ag. Ag has to do its part, too. And ag has fought every effort to force efficiency, groundwater protection. They have enormous power in Sacramento. And so Californians are also going to need to put a lot of pressure on their state legislators and on the governor to take some bold action. There's some obvious solutions there to make our water use more efficient. It's going to take courage and political will.
Okay, so on the point of agriculture, because this obviously, and it should, come up on every show. David, what can you tell us about how water is delivered to... I mean, we're talking about like multinationals when we're talking about agriculture. I mean, I'm sure there's probably a big difference between small farms and massive like factory farms in the way that water is delivered.
It really all seems to be where you are with respect to your water rights and what source of water you're drawing upon. So if you're fortunate enough to have access to one of the state or federal project waters, you know, life is good and you get delivered water based upon when your land was bought and what your water rights are. If you're left out of that equation, you're kind of on your own. And these are the people who are digging deeper groundwater wells and pumping as much water as they can just to stay in business.
What are your thoughts on Adam's point that these water companies are not doing enough because their profits will go down if people start to really conserve?
Well, remember, these are municipal agencies. They represent the people, and they're nonprofits. And so when we say that their profits go down, what we're really saying is, you know, when Adam talks about a revenue addiction, I think he's suggesting that we should fire people who work at the water agencies and stop maintaining the pipes in a time of drought. And that's exactly not the time to do it. So what I would like to see is more partnerships between water agencies and city governments and NGOs to say, you know what, we're all going to conserve during this drought, but our net water bills are going to remain the same or they might even go up. And that's just the reality of managing an urban water system. So again, if water is not delivered on a price per gallon, but a number, price per customer served, we should expect our volumetric water rates to increase during times of drought.
Well, certainly fixed costs, there's a question of what's reasonable in terms of fixed costs. And I would argue that water agencies have been living pretty high off the hog last 20, 30 years, whereas pretty much every other government agency has had to make cutbacks in a bad economy. Most water agencies have not. And so my heart is not bleeding with sympathy if we force and ask water agencies to become more efficient, especially in the drought. And I think customers should demand that and expect that. Certainly, we're not talking about automatically firing people. That's not the point at all. The point is about responsibility to customers because ultimately it is their money they are the source of the water agency's revenues. If I could just jump back to ag a little bit, I want to be a little bit more specific here.
Yeah.
We're talking
about... Wait, can I just ask you one question on the municipalities? How could the system be changed so ratepayers are not penalized for conserving water? And again, the LA Times, there's a great graph, and we do have it at yourcallradio.org. So San Francisco consumes, this is residential gallons per capita per day, 45 gallons per day, compared to San Diego County, 584. I mean, massive, massive discrepancy. What needs to change so if we do conserve, we're not charged more.
Well, in a drought, the situation you laid out is a, points to the need for statewide action by the statewide water board, and that's why they're taking the step this week about going after outdoor water waste. And certainly it's a lot higher in San Diego and Southern California than in San Francisco. There are parts of Sacramento, Fresno, the East Bay, Costa County, where there's lots of high outdoor irrigation use. And if the water agencies aren't going to do what's needed to preserve water throughout the decade, then the state needs to step up and crack the whip a little bit. So that's appropriate because our state's water is so interconnected, it's not fair or right for one city to do its part and another city to not do its part. So the State Water Board should be doing these steps, and it should be doing a lot more to ensuring we're going to have water in years to come.
And what did you want to clarify about your agriculture
comment? Well, going back to the State Water Board and Governor Brown, there's a need to look at agricultural practices that are also being affected and are taking water from our state's water system. We have more and more almond and pistachio trees in the last 3-4 years have been planted on the dry west side of the Central Valley. I'm talking about the I-5 corridor. We have the largest irrigation district that most people have never heard of called the Westlands Water District, which continues to demand more and more water to plant and to irrigate year-round crops such as almond and pistachio trees, most of which are exported. In his famous book, Cadillac Desert, Mark Reisner describes the debate about whether it was ever appropriate to irrigate that hot and dry west side. It's much different than the east side of the valley, which is closer to the Sierras. Right now we're seeing in this drought, there's simply not enough water for everybody to be happy. And this leads to a political stalemate sometimes or inaction, but that's not going to work anymore, especially in this drought. And if it's going to continue, we're going to need to make some hard choices. And certain practices that just do not have reasonable and beneficial use for the people of California need to be eliminated. And it's probably time to retire that toxic land in the desert on the west side of the valley.
David, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, good luck to you. I think a lot of people have been trying to fight this fight for decades now, and it's slow going. But I agree with Adam that eventually we're going to have a day of reckoning on some of the agriculture that's happening in these very hot and dry places, and that water could be put to a lot more productive use in California cities. So when we see cities investing in very expensive new water projects, we're doing that because we can't get access to that water that's being used for the kinds of activities that Adam's talking about now. So whenever we see massive investments being made on water projects within cities, there is a solution out there of taking that water back from agriculture. But like I said, we've been at this for many decades now, and in a time of drought, cities are starting to go their own way because they don't believe that we're going to break that political logjam without a lot of pain and suffering in the urban economies.
Well, again, on Thursday, we are going to talk about food, so I'll definitely bring up pistachios and almonds. We'll talk about the meat and dairy industries. There's a lot to talk about on Thursday's show. Today, we are joined by David Sedlak, professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Berkeley and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Adam Scow is California director at Food and Water Watch. And today, we are talking specifically about the water system, how water is delivered, what does the infrastructure look like, what is efficient and inefficient, what needs to change. And if you have any on-point questions, I know this is a massive topic, and we get callers about you name it. There's so many issues here, and that's why we decided to spend a week on this. But if you have specific questions about water delivery and the infrastructure and what you think needs to change, also the health of the pipes, because that's really important. Leaks, we'll talk about that in a minute. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about old and leaky pipes. Last year, the San Jose Mercury News had an investigation looking at these things that are underground and really out of sight. And it found that We had enough leaks to submerge Manhattan by 5 feet, enough to meet the needs of 71,000 families for an entire year. Bay Area water agencies have lost from 3% to 16% of their treated water because of leaks. Adam, how well do we keep track of this, and why doesn't this get more attention?
Well, like you said, it's out of sight, out of mind, and at the statewide level, there's been more interest in building new infrastructure of questionable public value rather than focusing on fixing what we already have. And we really have no choice. We have to replace leaking pipes and fix the sewer systems in our cities. We absolutely have to do that. It's going to be very expensive to do that. Just recently, LA Times reported the city of LA is looking $2 to $5 billion to replace all of their water mains. Water mains are breaking there every week on a regular basis. Here in San Francisco, we're undergoing a $5 to $7 billion revamp of our wastewater treatment facilities. And also a similar $5 billion renovation of the Hetch Hetchy water system, where these are wealthy cities. San Francisco and Los Angeles were in better positions to make those investments. When you get into smaller cities and more rural places, this infrastructure is still very expensive, but there's simply not as many people to help pay for it. So this is where we think it's appropriate to have the state and federal government as partners in helping cities and their people pay for this infrastructure. The leaks are tremendous. It's estimated, but nobody knows for quite sure how much water we lost as a state from leaks. But I've heard from 500,000 acre feet to 1 million acre feet. That's more water than Los Angeles uses in an entire year. So the rate of replacement is also something to look at. We need to increase that. It's been very slow. It's been estimated that some cities, L.A., it's going to take over 150 years at the current rate of replacement to fix their problem. So we need to figure a way to accelerate that, to get the investment where it's needed. And we think it is appropriate that the feds and the state are partners, because this is really in the state and national interest. It's not going to be easy. Nothing's easy. It's going to take public pressure.
David, what do you think it's going to take?
Well, Rose, all water systems leak. And so it's actually inefficient to have to spend the money that it would take to make a system that didn't leak at all. And so, you know, the experts assume that somewhere around 5 to 10% leaks is about the right break-even point for running a system where it's economically efficient and you're finding all of the big leaks. I think the problem that we're facing now is that we made these massive investments in urban water infrastructure in the 20th century, and based upon the kinds of pipes we used, unfortunately, they're all wearing out at about the same time. That is, the pipes that we put in before World War II had lifetimes on the order of 70 to 80 years. The pipes that we put in the 60s had lifetimes of 40 or 50 years. And so those first generation pipes are all wearing out simultaneously. And when we set the rates for our water systems, we didn't take into account the replacement costs. And that's because a lot of those systems were built with large amounts of federal subsidies. And so what I think we need to do is consider the replacement costs of all of our infrastructure when we build new projects and when we set the billing rates for people. And this points back to my concern that if you just think about charging for water on the basis of the number of gallons delivered, you don't take into account that it's the same water infrastructure system, the same number of pipes wearing out at the same rates, whether you take 1 million gallons out of that system or 500,000 gallons out of that system. And so it points to coming to a recognition of the expense of maintaining and operating a first world water system.
David, will the $7 billion water bond that was passed by California voters in November address any of these issues?
A lot like Adam, my suspicion is that there's going to be a lot more glory associated with building new water systems and new water infrastructure than there will on replacing the parts that are wearing out. So we'll probably get some new off-channel reservoirs to support agriculture, and we'll invest in some rainwater harvesting systems and water recycling programs within cities, and maybe even some water conservation. But I doubt that much of that money is going to go to pipe replacement.
Adam?
It's going to be a battle on how that money is going to be spent. We opposed Proposition 1 because of our concerns that the money would be unfairly channeled to new projects that have questionable public benefit. However, now that it's passed, we have an opportunity for the public to weigh in, to get in touch with their state assembly members or state senators, and demand that that money be spent on local and regional self-sufficiency to fix the pipes back home. These new dams that have been talked about for Big Ag are going to be very expensive, and we think it's just a way to further their greed and is inappropriate use of public money. So I really encourage all the listeners to get involved with this fight as to how Proposition 1 funds are going to be spent, and they can be in touch with us at foodandwaterwatch.org.
What's the time frame on this?
I think we're looking at about all year and maybe into next year as well. It's going to be a long time frame. Earlier that legislators hear from their people, the better.
And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Again, it's a $7 billion bond. And recently, Lester Snow, former head of the California Natural Resources Agency, says the state will need $6 to $12 billion annually for water infrastructure projects. Annually? And so that's $7 billion is just a fraction. That's a lot of money.
Absolutely. And it's why it's so important that it's allocated in a responsible and wise way, because you can easily waste $6 to $12 billion on projects that really won't create a drop of new water for most Californians. And let's also make that point now that California is not going to produce more water. There's some seduction about desalination and recycled water. Sure, they'll help in very small ways, but there's no silver bullet solution. We have a lot of water as a state. It's important to remember that. We do have a lot of water. We're getting less of it. So now it's a question of management and prioritization. And especially in this drought, where it's going to force us to make some hard choices. But we're not going to be producing new water in California. This is what we've got. We got to be a lot smarter and make some tough choices.
Amy says, do your experts see a time in the next 10 years when water does not flow from our home taps? David?
Nope. I absolutely think that the idea of water not flowing out of the tap, at least in our major cities, is unthinkable. I think the place, if there is any place in California where water doesn't flow out of our taps, it's going to be some of the small cities, like, as Adam said, don't have the economic wherewithal to respond to these challenges. But most of your listeners live in big cities and are served by large municipal water agencies, and it's hard for me to imagine a time in the next decade or two when water doesn't flow out of the tap.
We did talk to some small communities outside of Los Angeles who rely on wells, and they are relying on bottled water for basics because they're not getting water. It's too expensive.
And there's a small town on the east side of the valley called Porterville, also relying on bottled water. There's many farm worker communities that have not had clean drinking water in the last 10 to 20 years because their water has been polluted by fertilizers and nitrates, and have long relied on paying 10 to 100 times more for their water than what we pay for here in the Bay Area. So I agree, those of us who are fortunate to be in the Bay Area or Los Angeles will probably be okay. But certain folks in the Central Valley are already suffering.
Yeah, we'll have to get an update from Porterville. That's the town. We had someone on from that town a couple months ago. Adam Scow is California Director at Food and Water Watch. David Sedlak is Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Berkeley and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What do you want to know about California's new groundwater laws? On the next Your Call, we'll continue our week-long series on California's water crisis by talking about the state's first-ever rules for pumping groundwater. Nearly 40% of California's water comes from underground sources. About 30 million Californians rely on groundwater for their water. But areas are being pumped faster than they're being replenished. So how is groundwater managed now, and what changes should we expect? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.